Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org.
How many veterans know that Israel attacked a U.S. boat? You guys know about that? The USS Liberty.
Liberty.
You guys know about it, but how many veterans know that? You know, red-blooded Americans that claim to be pro-Israel know that Israel attacked and in broad daylight, flying the U.S. flag, because it was monitoring the Israeli advance during the 6-7 war.
That was Krishna Maiden, Veterans for Peace member, immigrant, and he has also been a history teacher in Florida and elsewhere with an expertise in the Middle East. And we will hear more from Krishna. But first, my name is Jim Wolgemuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We're members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country thanks to the Pacifica Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcast, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps Radio Free Nashville going, and as a result, this radio show is then picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network so that we are heard across the country. So if you think this is important, just go to radiofreenashville.org and click on the donate button and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone. And if you support the work of Veterans for Peace, go to veteransforpeace.org. We've got a donate button there also. So while the mainstream media, YouTube, Twitter, and other platforms are censoring voices of activism and dissent, we will continue to share those voices who stand up against the establishment, who stand up against the military, industrial, congressional, media, corporate complex, who stand up for us, the global us. Okay, before we get going, this is the week of November 22nd. And November 22nd, 1963, changed a lot for this country and the world. And for me, as I sat in my ninth grade English class watching my hardcore teacher, Mrs. Kelly, completely melt down, I was saddened and stunned. But while I felt the loss of John Kennedy, I did not realize just how much that day would change my life and so many lives. Kennedy, as documents have shown, and as Daniel Ellsberg wrote, was considering getting out of Vietnam. Of course, we do not know if he would have actually done it, gotten us out, but we do know he was considering it and had written plans to do it. Just consider, I would not have had to join the Navy to avoid Vietnam, but ended up in Vietnam anyway. But more importantly, 50,000 names, more than 50,000 names, would not be on the wall. There were some killed during the Kennedy administration, but after John Kennedy, 50,000. Now, don't get me wrong. Things worked out for me, for sure. I survived and thrived. But things did not work out for millions of people, including the 50,000 on the wall and millions in Vietnam, just because of that day in Dallas. Thank you. Now on with the show. Before we get to our interview with you, Krishna, I also wanted to state again, like we did last week on the show, that VFP has come out in support of Rashida Tlaib. And I just want to say that they did an open letter to the 212 Republicans and 22 Democrats who voted to censure Representative Rashida Tlaib on November 7th. Veterans for Peace did this on the 12th, and I'll just read a little bit of this. It says, your November 7th vote to censure Rashida Tlaib for her statements condemning the genocidal slaughter Israel is perpetrating in Gaza was one of shameless hypocrisy. So that's where I'll leave it, because you get the gist of it. And for anybody who's interested, and I hope a lot of people are, you can read the whole statement by just going to veteransforpeace.org, veteransforpeace.org.
Okay. That is wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. So today we have a special guest to talk about a number of things. We have Krishna Madan. So, Krishna, could you start by talking about yourself a little bit before we get into our discussion of Middle East?
Sure.
Because I know that you're not only a veteran, but you're an immigrant. So let's start there. Where did you come from? When did you get here?
I'm from Guyana.
And why did you join the military? So off you go.
Well, so I'm from Guyana, which is a country in the northern part of South America. It's English speaking, so culturally it's Caribbean. I'm of Indian descent myself. The other major part of the population is Afro-Guyanese of African descent. So two major population groups. My family came here because of political problems in Guyana that was actually orchestrated by Britain and the US. We had an independence movement in the 50s that had about 85% of the backing of the people. You had a united movement of Indians and blacks trying to find independence and trying to get a socialist reformist movement to help the people who had been exploited by slavery and by indentured laborers. The Indians, like my ancestors, came through indentured labor, horribly exploited, as were the slaves. So you had a very impoverished population that wanted some amelioration of its condition. Now, our united movement, we had local self-government where the British were transitioning to give the colonies independence. But they didn't like our particular government because it was like a radical socialist government. So after 153 days in 1953, before I was born, they landed troops and overthrew the government and then endeavored to split the two racial groups, Indians and blacks. So you get them at odds, you know, divide and conquer, you get them at odds with each other. So I remember growing up in the 60s and remember hearing stuff about riots and terrorism. And it would be revealed, we knew at the time, but it would be revealed later by Philogy, who wrote the book, I think, Inside the Company, one of the first exposés of the CIA. They called it their cheapest regime change. Only cost them, I don't know, maybe about a couple hundred thousand, very few lives lost, relatively a few hundred, and they were able to change and get a government that was more favorable to them. So it was in that condition of the new government that became a dictatorship that my family immigrated from Guyana to the States in 1970 when I was 15. Mm. So like, you know, I'm here as a sort of a refugee. Like you have Central Americans and you have people from Iraq and Vietnam and so on. I guess we should be grateful immigrants. But if we explain why we're here, then we're ungrateful immigrants. I was a pretty good student back home, but then coming to the States as an immigrant, didn't have any way to pay for college. So after I graduated in 72, at the age of 17, I decided to join as many minority folks or poor folks were doing to join the military to get the GI Bill. You know, that's one of the reasons actually why we don't have free college, because how are you going to get kids in the military if you give them free college? So this whole withholding of education that we see today from youth is to encourage poor white folks, poor black folks, poor minorities to join the military so that they can get that GI Bill. So I joined the military 72 to 75 and got out and studied international affairs. That's my first degree. And been working as a teacher more or less since.
Okay, where'd you get your degree from?
Well, I have a few degrees. So I have international affairs from University of Nebraska. I had a buddy in the Army from one of the little, from Cozad, Nebraska. Actually, he's home to a KKK or something, but whatever. But he was a good friend, and I wanted to see the heartland, you know. Because when I first came to the States, we were in New York, and New York is not typical. I wanted to see the real America. So I got my first degree from University of Nebraska, Lincoln, Big Red. I have another degree in political philosophy from England and one in English as a second language from University of Hawaii.
All right. So it's very interesting, your description, and if you don't mind me jumping back.
No,
so your family came here to avoid the dictatorship that was installed in your country by the people from the UK and from the US, meaning the CIA.
Yes, so, exactly.
So you're You're kind of the product of what we did to when we overthrow. We take the power away from the people, and all of a sudden, here right. come the people. And we're glad you're here, but it's just one of those stories that we need to get a handle on. That if we didn't mess with other countries, maybe people would be able to live the lives they want to in their home.
Exactly. Most immigrants don't come because this is some ideal place. They come because of the push factor, what's been happening back home. There's actually a great documentary about that called The Harvest of Empire. It's in Spanish, Cosecha del Imperio. It's also in English, Harvest of Empire, that interviews people from all over Latin America, and then you get their story why they come, and it's similar to mine. It's not unique.
Not unique.
It's worse than mine. It's worse than mine, because what happened in those countries, far worse than what happened in Guyana.
Sure, sure. And so what branch of the service did you join?
I joined the Army, and I went into infantry. I had always been sort of bookish, so I decided, okay, if I have to do this, let me do the real thing, not be a clerk jerk or whatever. And so I did infantry training.
So you went in 72?
I went in 72 and got out in 75. So the tail end of Vietnam.
I was going to say, there was still some stuff going on over there.
There was stuff going on. 75 was when Saigon fell, if you remember.
Okay.
So I was stationed in Hawaii. So we were put on alert for the possibility that if Nixon wanted, he could have sent us. And we would have been the first ones to go, coming from, you know, Hawaii, I guess maybe after the folks in Korea.
You didn't get that privilege, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And so you went into the military just to get the GI Bill, just so you could get your education. And
right.
Very good. And then you joined Veterans for Peace.
Yeah.
Tell us what brought you to Veterans for Peace.
Well, I've always been aware of what I remember VVAW. I mean, that was the original, right? Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So, you know, that was iconic. That was the iconic anti-war veterans organization. So it's a natural for me, for, you know, someone who was reluctantly in the military.
You became a teacher. Well, go ahead. Tell us about becoming a teacher.
Taught in Hawaii and taught over here. I've taught high school, college, different levels.
Oh, excellent. And then you landed in Florida.
Right.
And now this is where I don't know which way to go. I know I want to get your perspective about the Middle East, but I also want you to get your perspective about teaching in DeSantis's Florida.
So maybe let's talk about that, then we can end up with the Middle East as the bulk.
All right.
Well, luckily for me, I haven't had to teach when DeSantis started coming out with his crackdown on, quote, woke in education and elsewhere, because I retired during COVID. So I'm a kind of a performance teacher. You know, I talk, I joke with the kids, and online teaching didn't really go well with that. And you could be monitored, whatever. I like to make all sorts of jokes with the kids, which you can't do on the camera or whatever. You know, if a kid is sassy or says F you or whatever, you know, I'll hit them back with something in return, but you can't do that if you're being recorded, you know? So I retired during COVID. So at his anti-education measures came out after COVID. So luckily I've been spared of, but I do hear from colleagues that people have had to clean the books out of their classrooms. And some of the shelves are really empty for a while because they just didn't know what was allowed and what was not allowed. And you'd be in trouble if you had the wrong book on your shelf.
And would you have had to change your subject matter as far as what you actually taught?
Yes. And that's why I'm glad I'm retired, because I would either be in a whole lot of trouble if I were still teaching, and I would be up before having to explain myself. I'd probably be fired. So, yeah. Yeah, definitely from what he has come up with.
You can relate to some of that, can't you, Jim?
Well, I can. I was a sixth grade teacher in social studies in North Carolina, and this was before COVID. I actually retired in 2014. Teaching in North Carolina was, in rural North Carolina, was kind of interesting because while I was teaching social studies, I was also providing the kids some information that went counter to our science teacher, meaning right. I said that global warming was actually real. And our science teacher said, was telling the kids, no, it wasn't real.
Oh, God.
And you know, we can teach peace. We don't have to go, we don't have to teach history. Just this war happened, this country won, then the next war happened in 20 years. You can teach some of the people who worked for peace along the way. And, you know, I got called to the office a number of times where parents didn't think I was patriotic enough.
Yeah.
And the principal, God bless him, he would stand up for me no matter what, and often said, not patriotic enough, he's a Vietnam veteran. Being a teacher these days is very interesting. And I understand you even wrote a book.
Yes, I have a book called The Teacher's Manifesto that talks about teachers being blamed for what are basically social problems. Because they talk about bad scores, but where do you get the bad performances in education? It's not in the rich white suburbs. Those do well. Those kids do well. You get the poor performances where you have a poor population. But teachers who have to deal with the most difficult areas and the most difficult students, they get the blame for the problems that the kids manifest because of the social circumstances. Yeah.
If people want to know more about your book, where can they go?
It's on Amazon. It's called The Teacher's Manifesto. But they have to look by my name, Krishna Madan. Teacher's Manifesto, Krishna Madan.
Okay. Very good. All right. So let's get to the Middle East. And the one thing I'd like to get your perspective on, because we know about all the horror that has been going on, but what do you believe might be the possibility or probability of a wider war, and how would that shake out?
I think it all depends on how Israel proceeds in Gaza. If it continues to kill so much of the civilian population, if it decides to go south, it really just depends on what Israel does as to whether then Hezbollah will feel compelled to retaliate, to take some of the pressure off the people of Gaza. The war expanding would be pretty much because Hezbollah decides to back up the Palestinians by diverting some of the Israeli military so that they can't oppress and kill Palestinians as easily.
Okay, so, and by going south, you mean into Egypt?
No, sorry. I meant into southern Gaza. Right now, the Israelis are focused on northern Gaza. Israel really wants, ideally, an ethnic cleansing like it did in 47 to 49, where it ethnically cleansed 750,000 Palestinians out of Palestine, out of the areas Israel took over in Palestine. And Israel would like the same thing. Then you would not have a Gaza problem anymore if you can get those Gazans to be in the Sinai in Egypt. So if that were to be happening, if let's say on the West Bank, the settlers start ethnically cleansing Palestinians also, which is happening on a small scale.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't get nearly as much attention, but it's in fact, it's been out of control quite a while before any October 7th.
Yes.
All these towns being literally, you know, raised to the ground and
right,
the politicians cheering them on.
Yes, with genocidal rhetoric, reminiscent of the Nazis.
Wipe them out.
Could you compare what happened to 48 to what's happening now as far as scale, as far as strategy?
Well, as far as the military measures used, obviously the military is much more advanced. So in 47, you had about 15,000 Palestinians killed in the course of various ethnic cleansing and massacres, such as Deir Yassin, Tantura, causing the Palestinian exodus. Obviously, now there's a lot more civilians being killed because weaponry has increased. And it's not a personal ethnic cleansing like it was in 48, where they were just going to villages and shoot people face to face. Right now, it's from the air, but on the scale that we see, I mean, we have over 1 million Palestinians have left, not in Gaza.
Yeah.
So that is comparable in scale to what happened between 47 and 49. Yeah.
Actually, sounds a little bigger what's going on right now.
Exactly. Right.
So, what do you see is going to make Israel stop?
It would have to be as with South Africa. South Africa was carrying on merrily until the international community and the South African backers were forced to, because of local pressure in the US, in England, in Europe, to divest and boycott South African products. So basically, we need and there's a website for this called the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. And it's a website you can look up. And this website tells you companies you can boycott that support Israel. But to get our politicians to stop supporting Israel both directly, but then start to put sanctions on Israel. So we see this where Biden has done a little mini, mini baby step. He has said that if any of the settlers in the West Bank attack Palestinians, they'll be put on a US sanction list. They won't be allowed to visit the US. Well, that's not much of a sanction, you know, that you won't be allowed to visit the US. But remember, these settlers are breaking international law just by being on occupied Palestinian territory. But he's only making a contingent upon them attacking Palestinians. By just being there, they're already breaking the law. We need the same sanctions on Israel, say that the US has put on Russia. If you can put sanctions on Russia, why can't you put them on Israel?
It's military occupation, same
Yes,
thing.
exactly.
Yeah, and if you want, go a little bit deeper into that because it seems like our hypocrisy has no limits.
Yes, the politicians are hypocritical, but they have to be hypocritical. And that gets to campaign contributions, which affects so many different areas. Have you guys seen the video, the documentary video called Why We Fight?
Yes.
There was a classic one of World War II, but not that one, not the Capra one. This is one about, you know, how campaign contributions by the weapons manufacturers causes the people in Congress to vote for military expenditures that are not needed. Well, the AIPAC lobby, it works the same way. The top US political science professor is John Mearsheimer. He's with the University of Chicago. He's acknowledged to be the top political science professor. He has a book called The Israel Lobby, the US and the Israel Lobby. That and he talks about it on YouTube. He is worth listening to. He shows how the Israel lobby influences our politicians, because if they vote for Palestine or they vote for Palestinian rights, this AIPAC, this Israel lobby will fund their opposition. So you lose your position if you stand against Israel. So this whole thing of campaign contributions affects so many areas. In effect, it explains why we have corrupt politicians beholden to corporations, beholden to the military-industrial complex, and beholden to Israel.
So that brings us all the way back to what you said just before, that we need to get Israel to stop. We need to put pressure and possibly through BDS, but it doesn't seem like we have the resources to actually do that.
Yes, we have to build a mass movement. And so, what you find if you go to the Palestinian rallies for a ceasefire, there are many affiliated organizations, left and progressive organizations, that are working with the Palestinians because they realize that this issue is connected. It's connected to the whole idea of militarism. It's connected to the malign influence that campaign contributions plays in the society and in our country. So by building the alliance and by educating the people who know that there's something wrong with the system, eventually, somehow, there becomes a moment when you are no longer this weird minority, but you become like a recognized and influential minority.
And you just came back from a rally.
I just came back from a rally in West Palm Beach. We had at least 500 people there. There were about 10 to 15 counter protesters. Now, speaking of the media gave us one paragraph. And it didn't, I was interviewed. I didn't see my interview. Maybe it'll be in later. But I didn't see that anything I said. They just said people were screaming free Palestine. See that word? Screaming free Palestine. But then they talked to the counter protesters, all 10, 15 of them versus our 500, and give them two paragraphs to say what they had to say. That's our media. But you know what the Israeli side does? And if you guys play sports, you know the thing called working the refs.
You bet.
Well, that's what the pro-Israel side does. They work the ref, they work the media, they work the politicians, they work the education system, so that those folks have to lean way over to the pro-Israel side. Otherwise, they get worked. And the great biggest way to work the ref, meaning the media, is to say, "Hey, you're being anti-Semitic."
We understand, or we believe, there's nothing anti-Semitic about us protesting or being for a ceasefire for Palestinian human rights. And
Exactly.
at the same time, we don't associate what the government of the state of Israel is doing with being anti-Jewish. But like you said, the media and AIPAC works the refs.
And their narrative is basically part of the style book for all the major media. Their narrative is what you have to be loyal.
Yes. And in the narrative that Americans have of this issue, there is no understanding of that ethnic cleansing Palestinians experience. And I would like to point out it the ethnic cleansing started before the 1948 war. The 1948 war started when Israel declared independence on May 14, 1948, and was attacked by the Arab states. So this is what the media projects. Oh, look, poor little Israel just declared independence, got attacked. But what had happened before that was the ethnic cleansing. For example, the village of Deir Yassin totally wiped out in April of 48, before Israel declared independence. 300,000 Palestinians had already been made refugees when Israel declared independence. You don't get that. The Arabs came in to save the Palestinians, actually, because their people demanded the governments go and save the Palestinians. But it's proclaimed as like some anti-Semitic attack by the Arab states, when really they were trying to save the Palestinians from this ethnic cleansing that was unfolding since like November, December of 47.
And the British had been working even before that to undermine the Palestinians and disarm them, et cetera.
Right. There was a great Arab revolt in the 1930s, and the British cracked down, and they used some of the Zionist militias to help break that Palestinian resistance, which explains then why the Palestinians were so weak when the 48 war came about. Israel had all sorts of modern weaponry. And remember, it was supported by both the capitalist world, the US and Europe, but also the communist world. The Soviet Union voted, and its satellites voted for Israel. So basically, the Palestinians had no chance. Israel was getting supported by all the advanced industrial countries with modern Czech weapons. The Palestinians had old British things that hardly worked or whatever. So the image you have of what happened in 48 versus the reality is two different things.
So why? Well, first of all, I had a question. Could you have taught to your class today what you just talked about?
No, because then you would get maybe some Zionist students complaining to their parents, or evangelical Christian students complaining to their parents, and then you would get complained to the principal. So I've always been very quiet about this in the classroom. I'd like to tell you, there was a few times, not here in Florida, I kept quiet in Florida until I retired, but in Hawaii and in Nebraska, where I wrote letters to the newspaper, and there would just be this flood of responses trying to get me fired. I taught at Chaminade University in Hawaii, and I wrote a letter about Palestine and what the Palestinians had experienced. They had to open up a special line that said, "Are you calling to complain about Mr. Madan? Dial, five or whatever." This is a Zionist technique. They will just flood with complaints. Another private school, Catholic school, I taught at Heights High School on Maui. They got a flood of letters when I spoke something about Israel, and it was on the national news, saying he should be fired, he should be fired. My principal showed me the letters, So this is a technique they use, which shuts people up,
Yeah.
which is why you don't hear the Palestinian side in the US media nor in the schools.
And it's getting to be the same way in the colleges.
Yes, right. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what they're doing with the colleges now.
Yeah.
You are listening to our interview with Krishna Madan, member of Veterans for Peace, scholar, activist, and Middle Eastern expert.
There's so many truths that as a teacher, we couldn't talk about.
Right.
You couldn't talk about, you know, and that is to the detriment of every student and to the detriment of us as a country, because unless we know the country with its warts, I think we're in trouble. It's good to know that we have made mistakes in the past. It's good to know on what side we were. And it's good to know if we were on the wrong side of history or the right side of history.
It's also self-interest. Because if you look at the U.S.'s problems with the Muslim world, a lot of it goes back to the Palestine conflict. Mm-hmm. Osama made a vow. Okay, 1982, Israel attacked Lebanon. And what it's doing to Gaza, it did a similar thing to Beirut, where it just leveled entire city blocks. In his third letter, you know, remember Osama was sending letters ever so often when he was in his mountain hideout, and he would send letters to America ever so often. In his third letter, he said, "I got the inspiration for the Twin Towers when I saw Israel using American bombs to level Beirut." Mm. That's in his third letter, and you can look it up. So the U.S. support for Israel pits us against the Muslim world, which is incomprehensible how we can support that oppression. And so one of the reasons we got into the Iraq war was because Israel wanted to destroy. Israel wants us to destroy any Islamic or Arab country that will support the Palestinians. Iran would be the next one. And so it gets our veterans killed. It's our expenditure that's going to these wars, mm-hmm. all for the sake of propping up this apartheid state called Israel.
If I hear you correctly, Israel would just love if we went to war with Iran.
Oh, that's an open secret, right? you didn't need me to tell you that.
No. Do you think Israel is continuing this genocide in Gaza, hoping to push a response from some of the Arab countries?
That's an excellent question. You know, I hadn't thought about that. To try to trigger Iran to do something that would result in Israel and the U.S. then having a pretext to attack Iran. Mm-hmm. I'd never thought about that. That wouldn't be surprising at all. That's a very perceptive question.
Well, every once in a while. So, but that does bring up something that I've been wondering about. This has been going on for a month or more. Yeah, almost 6 weeks, or maybe 6 weeks. And I would have expected, with the level of devastation, that other Arab countries would have stepped in, or at least would have made a bigger stink than they are. And it, you know, you mentioned before that the Palestinians have been left basically out to dry, with the communists supporting Israel and the capitalists supporting Israel
in
48. So they're left alone, and it looks like they're left alone again.
Yes, because the U.S. has been working to get the Arab states away from supporting the Palestinians, Egypt, Jordan, and then you had Trump with the Abraham Accords. So that's the technique, to where the Palestinians then just become like Native Americans. They'll just be on their little reservations controlled by Israel. And that's what the U.S. and Israel was hoping to do. Now, since October 7th, that may not be as easily possible, because the Arab population is aroused.
I just feel like short of, a country like Iran or an Arab country actually expanding the war, Israel is going to get to do whatever they want to do, because that's U.S. is agreed. There are no red lines. And
exactly.
It's not contingent on anything they do or did. And to me, that will not end well for Israel. And it's so irresponsible to.
And it's also illegal. When the U.S. provides when the U.S. provides weapons to a country, one of the stipulations is you cannot use it in
your occupation.
Exactly. Right. But Israel uses U.S. weapons for aggressive purposes in the occupied territories. That's a totally illegal use of U.S. weapons, according to usual aid.
Yes. And I think what Netanyahu is doing is he's using the existential dread of the Israeli population now in the wake of this attack, where they thought they were invincible because of their wonderful security system, and nobody had to pay any attention to Palestinians and what they might want.
Right.
You just mow the lawn every year and a half, and now the people of Israel are scared to death because they can't trust their security system that they thought was invincible. And the idea that genocide against the Palestinians is going to restore their peace and serenity just defies all history in terms of what happened. Palestinians don't have the state power to wage war, but how many millions of Arabs in that part of the world are going to be ready to die to avenge the Palestinians? And you're just going to have a terrible upsurge in terror.
Exactly. That's where you're going to, that's what we're doing, is sowing the seeds of terror for the future.
And I forget where I saw it, but I thought it was very apt that terror is the war of the poor, and war is the terror of the rich.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I'd also like to raise this whole idea of human shields. We've heard the criticism that Hamas uses human shields. But I want you to look at the idea that Israel uses human shields to a greater extent.
You certainly
do. Under international law, it is illegal to place your population on conquered territory. It's a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. But Israel does that. It did that with territory it conquered in the 48 war, territory that was not allocated to Israel, land where Palestinians had been uprooted and ethnically cleansed. It placed its settlers. It placed its settlers in the West Bank, about 500,000 already. So what are those people? They are human shields. If you put your civilians on land you conquer, you are creating human shields. You're saying, oh, you can't attack me here on this land I conquered, because then you're killing civilians. That's the definition of a human shield. But why isn't that? Why doesn't the media raise that concept against Israel? Far greater use of human shields.
And they have used Palestinians as human shields in the West Bank for a long time as well.
Yes, there are pictures, and you can see them, of Israeli, when they occupied Gaza and in earlier parts of during the Intifada in the West Bank uprising, where they would put kids on the armored APCs, armored personnel carriers, so that the other kids wouldn't stone them.
Wow.
And speaking of hostages, okay, so we all know the 200 hostages Hamas holds, but the whole reason Hamas took those hostages is because Israel holds thousands of Palestinian hostages under a system called administrative detention. Yes. So it can just take you, put you in prison, does not have to bring charges anytime against you. That's indefinite. No. So you have people, including kids, including hundreds of kids, under this system of administrative detention. Now, that's a kidnapping.
And it's indefinite.
That's a hostage you're holding.
For years for that.
Yes, yes, yes. So the whole purpose of the Hamas hostages is to exchange the ones they took from Israel for the Palestinians who are under this hostage system that Israel uses, quote, legally.
And when you consider the siege, you know, the long 16 or 17 years of complete blockade and complete control of the Palestinians, there are over 2 million hostages in Gaza.
Exactly. Because then you're saying, if you launch an attack on me, I'm going to bomb your hostages. So basically, this bombing is hostages being punished. for what the Hamas military wing did.
Right.
And by the way, the political wing did not have any knowledge of the attack, because Israel has infiltrated the Palestinians so much that the military wing of Hamas that carried out the attacks did not even tell the political wing, in case they had some spies there. And so yeah, because of what the military wing did, the hostages that Israel holds, 2.2 million people of Gaza, are subject to reprisals.
Do you think Israel is going to go along with a swap like that?
I think that's why they're bombing so in a genocidal manner, so that maybe their Hamas will just throw up its arms and says, okay, just take the hostages and stop the bombing. They do not want to go along with an exchange like that, but they have done similar things in the past.
Yeah. I also read in The Guardian today that Biden has mentioned the possibility of both the West Bank and Gaza being put under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Netanyahu's not going to go along with that. What's your thought?
No, because Israel wants to depopulate Gaza, and it wants to have control over Gaza to prevent any repetition of the resistance. The problem is that the U.S. and Israel have turned the Palestinian Authority into basically... Do you remember the concept from the Holocaust called the Capos, C-A-P-O? So in the concentration camps, you know, you would have like maybe the Jewish area, the communist area, different, you know, the different groups that were in the Nazi concentration camps, incarcerated, Jews, gypsies, communists, and so on. They had their leaders who had to enforce Nazi policy. And the Capos, if you read what Holocaust survivors say, the Capos treated them worse than the Nazis did, because they had to prove, you know, they had to prove themselves. Otherwise, they could just become a regular prisoner again. The U.S. and Israel have turned the Palestinian Authority into Capos for the Palestinians, who have to keep the Palestinians down, who have to suppress any rebellion and so on. Yeah, maybe that's what they want the Palestinian Authority to do in Gaza, is to turn them into Capos so they can stifle any Palestinian resistance. Because that's what they have them doing in the West Bank to a great extent.
It is so hard a nut to crack here in the United States. A great majority of people want a ceasefire. But when we were talking to prepare for the interview, you said that you believed that you had a perspective as an immigrant and as somebody who grew up watching what possibly was happening in your country, and that you can might have a better perspective as far as what's going on. Could you talk about what's that and how we can try and get through to the regular old American public and really put the pressure on to?
Yes. And so I think that involves exploding some of the myths. So we already talked about the 48 war. The Israeli myth is, oh, we declared independence peacefully and then the Arab states attacked us. So that's why you have the Palestinian refugees. It's a result of the war the Arabs started. But if we look at the facts brought out by Israeli historians, there are a bunch of Israeli historians called the New Historians. There are people like Ilan Pape, and there's Benny Morris. Ilan Pape, Benny Morris. Those are two big names. And they've talked about the Palestinian refugee problem. They've talked about the Zionist terror groups that caused the ethnic cleansing. So if we can explode some of these myths, one, that Israel has been this innocent party always being attacked. You look at the 1956 war, Israel initiated that along with Britain and France to seize the Suez Canal. It initiated the 67 war and then took the Sinai and the West Bank and the Golan Heights. So, you know, to explode some of these myths that, because basically, see, this is where my perspective as an immigrant comes in, because a lot of the rest of the world knows that these are myths, but in the U.S. we don't. Because, again, because of the Israel lobby, and now because of the evangelical Christian, you know, some of these folks are really fanatically pro-Israel. And so there's these whole misconceptions about a lot of the history, people not knowing Palestinians were ethnically cleansed, not knowing that Israel initiated these wars for more territory to seize control of all of Palestine. And so I'm not knowing, for example, that Israel holds hostages, like I just mentioned. Israel uses human shields by putting people on occupied territory. Israel fails to comply with international law. Resolution 194 of the United Nations says that Israel should have withdrawn from a territory held right. by that it seized in 1948. By the way, during that war, Israel killed a UN ambassador, named Falk Bernadotte from one of the Scandinavian countries, F-O-L-K-E, Bernadotte. I think it was a Norwegian guy, because he was trying to stop the fighting and try to get Palestinian refugees to return. But Israel wanted that war to go on because it was able to seize more territory, displace more Palestinians. So they killed this UN ambassador. One of the things, how many veterans know that Israel attacked a U.S. boat? You guys know about that? The USS Liberty.
Liberty.
You guys know about it, but how many veterans know that?
No,
not many.
How many veterans that claim, you know, red-blooded Americans that claim to be pro-Israel know that Israel attacked and in broad daylight flying the U.S. flag because it was monitoring, the reason why it was monitoring the Israeli advance during the 6-7 war. And the U.S. was getting alarmed by how much territory. This was a spy ship, USS Liberty. Mm-hmm. And so it had all the modern equipment at that time. Monitoring the rapid Israeli advance in the lightning war. By the way, you know what the German word for lightning is?
Blitzkrieg.
Blitzkrieg. Yeah, right. Yeah. In the Blitzkrieg war. And so it outed the ship. Attacked it in broad daylight. And read what the U.S. veterans said. And this is for the audience, because you guys know, what did the U.S. veterans say? That it was a deliberate attack. Israel gets away with murder of Americans. Murder of Palestinians, yeah. Murder of Americans.
Murder of Americans.
Rachel Corrie.
Rachel Corrie, there you go.
Yeah.
I can just remember how people reacted back in the 67 war, and I think there's some racist factor in there, and
yes.
You know, sort of Orientalism, and, you know, the way Arabs have been depicted in
that is a big part of it,
culture and everything else.
That is a big part of it. Arabs are these dark, strange people, strange clothing and weird accents and whatever.
Violent.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, you have assimilated Jewish populations in the West, many of them being pro-Israel. So, you know, they seem like normal people. Mm-hmm. And these must be the right guys. They're like me. The guy who looks like me and sounds like me is going to be the one, right? And the weird one, but he's obviously the bad one, right?
So you mentioned the evangelicals, Christians, supporting Israel. And Christians do not have a good history with regard to mistreating Jews.
Exactly. And so, it's all for selfish purposes.
And what are those selfish purposes?
Because they want the end of the world.
Rapture.
These people want the end of the world. They want all the Jews to go there, and either they'll convert, and the ones that don't convert will die. It'll be the end of the world and the rapture and all that. I mean, how much more loony can you get?
Exactly. So
Netanyahu loves it, though. He considers the evangelicals to be there. Base in the U.S.
They're useful idiots. The evangelical Christians are useful idiots to Christians. Now, since we're talking about this, think of the people to whom Jesus preached. Well, who are their descendants today? Can you guys guess?
Palestinians.
Yes, Palestinians, specifically Palestinian Christians, but also the Muslim Palestinians were Palestinian Christians who would follow Jesus and then change to Islam. Palestinians are descendants of the people to whom Jesus preached, especially Palestinian Christians. So you get these nutcase evangelical Christians, but they're basically based on the Old Testament. If you look at their stuff, they're either Old Testament or Revelations, but they're not dealing with the words of Jesus. Jesus never said anything at all about Israel needing to be recreated. Never. No word at all. If it was important, Jesus would have said it. So these people aren't Christians. They're just like extreme Jewish nationalists with a loony wanting the world to end, millenarian, that's called, a bit of loony millenarian bent that want the world, want rapture and the world to end. They're not Christians at all in the sense of following Jesus.
And I've heard, too, that a significant percentage of the West Bank settlers are Americans.
Yes.
Went over specifically for that purpose.
And I mean, I'm just think of the arrogance. Think of that entitled arrogance. I'm a white Jewish person in America. I have a comfortable life, but I have the right to go and settle on Palestinian land because I'm white and because I'm Jewish. And see, this is where Zionism, which started in the late 1800s, came out of European nationalism. Zionism started at about the same time as right-wing fascist movements in Italy and Germany. That ultra-nationalism in Italy and Germany, Zionism was part of that same movement of national identity. And that's why it takes on that fascistic and that very aggressive thing, because it comes from that same European racist group. That was the height of European racism and imperialism, 1800s, when Zionism got started. It inherited that.
So do you think once Gaza is completely cleansed, once
let's say if Israel does that.
If Israel does do that, do they then turn and come up with an excuse to clean out the West Bank?
I think there are settlers who want something to happen in the West Bank.
And so the idea is right with them.
Yeah.
That's troubling. That's very troubling.
It is. And you know, Biden saying, oh, if they attack, then we won't let them come visit the U.S. You know, what is that?
Yeah.
It's like, you know the phrase damning with faint praise?
Oh, yeah.
I've made up the reverse. I haven't heard anybody else use it. Praising with faint dams. When you give somebody a little criticism, but you're in effect praising them because the criticism doesn't match the level of atrocity the person is engaged in. Right. So I call it praising with faint dams.
You're minimizing the harm that they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, we've kept you for almost an hour. And is there anything that you came prepared to say that you didn't get a chance to say that you wanted to say to get through to the audience?
So I would urge our veterans who are listening to this, I would urge conscientious Americans who are listening to this, please start talking to the people around you. Start looking up a couple of resources. ifamericansknew.com. This is written by an American woman, regular middle-class American woman. It's a great website. ifamericansknew, I think it's org, sorry. ifamericansknew.org. I'm not sure if it's org.com, but it's a very good, it's very well laid out to understand the Palestinian issue. Start listening to some of the Israeli critics. Ilan Pappe, look him up. Ilan Pappe on YouTube.
How do you spell that?
Ilan Pappe. He's a very outspoken critic of Israel.
There are YouTube segments with him.
Yeah, very effective. Yeah, so look up Ilan Pappe. Look up If Americans Knew. Org or com, whatever it is.
Breaking the Silence is another good one.
Breaking the Silence, yes, exactly. Jewish Voices of Peace. If you're Jewish, look at Jewish Voices of Peace. They're with us with our rallies all the time.
I'm a member. Great. We don't have any chapter here, but I pay my dues. I'm so impressed with what they do.
We have a couple, Donna and her husband, and they're very active here.
Yes.
This is the Jewish tradition of struggling for not only your rights, but the rights of everyone. Right. Zionism. See, every nationality has two sides, a universal side and a nationalistic side. And what Zionism has done, it's taken what was a great Jewish tradition of fighting for justice that you have in Europe, the socialist tradition and the labor tradition you had in America. Look at who our great organizers were for rights. They were Jewish people in America, but Zionism has perverted that to shift a lot of the consciousness now into this right-wing nationalism.
Well, Krishna, we'll have to leave it there, but we always end with a song. Do you have a song that might just reflect on what we've been talking that you'd like us to find and play to finish up the show?
Well, that's very interesting. You know, there's a lot of good Irish music. You know, the Irish are great for being in solidarity with Palestinians. Because they see it's the same damn thing that they experienced. Do you guys know that old bluegrass song, Darling Corey? You ever listen to Pete Seeger? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do lyrics for that. I'm not ready tonight. But instead of wake up, darling Corey, I'm going to wake up, Rachel Corey. What makes you sleep so sound? Them bulldozers are coming, going to crush you in the ground. Wow. I'm going to do that. So Rachel Corey was an American young woman who from the very young age wanted to work for peace. And she went to Palestine. And she was trying to, she was with the International Solidarity Movement, I think. And she went to try to prevent the destruction of Palestinian homes, which is collective punishment. And she stood in front of a bulldozer, I mean, the story, and she got crushed. So here's a takeoff on an American song, an American bluegrass song called Darling Corey. Pete Seeger done it, and a lot of different bluegrass people have done it. So this is Rachel Corey. Wake up, Lord Rachel Corey. What makes you sleep so sound? The bulldozers are coming, gonna crush you in the ground. Okay, mm-hmm. That's good.
Excellent.
Yeah, that and the March of Return. Those are two.
Exactly, right.
Just horrendous. They didn't even try to hide what they were doing.
No, no. Unarmed demonstrators, they would just shoot them, shoot the medics, shoot the people in the feet and whatever. So the people that tell Palestine, well, why don't you do it peacefully? Well, here, we did it, tried to do it peacefully in 2018, the Great March of Return, where they went to the fence to demonstrate their right to return. And they were just picked off like it was a video game, you know, it was like a video game. Yeah. The Israeli snipers picked them off like if they were a video game, shot, killed over 200, wounded thousands.
Thousands. Yep. And they maimed them permanently, the kind of...
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And what level of coverage did that get in the U.S. media?
Exactly. Right. Yeah,
on for weeks and weeks and months even.
Yes, I remember that really well.
Well, Krishna, very good. Any thoughts on a song and we'll let you go.
Here's a good one. And this is an Irish song, Come Out Ye Black and Tans. You know that?
Oh, yeah.
Because I love that song because it's Irish solidarity with the people of the rest of the world, the rest of the colonial world.
So that was Krishna Madan. And now, per his request, here's Come Out Ye Black and Tans by the Wolftones.
I was born on the Dublin street, where the loyal drums to beat, and those loving English feet, they walked all over us. And every single night, when me dad would come home tight, he'd invite the neighbours out with his chorus. Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lanes of Kilashandra. Come let us hear you tell how you slandered great Parnell when you thought him well and truly persecuted. Where are the sneers and jeers that you loudly let us hear when our leaders of 16 were executed? Come out, you black and tan, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lanes of Kilashandra. Come tell us how you slew them old Arabs two by two. Like the Zulus, they had spears and bow and arrows. How bravely you faced one with your 16-pounder gun, and you frightened them damn natives to the marrow. Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lanes of Kilashandra. Now the time is coming fast, and I think them days are here when each English Johnny and he'll run before us. And if there'll be a need, then our kids will say Godspeed with the verse or two of singing this fine chorus.
Come out, you blackened hands, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lanes of Killeshaw.